Sacrament, Cassette 4.
Chapter 5. Will didn't attempt a shortcut back to the courthouse, but took the road down to the village. At the intersection, there was a telephone box, and he thought, I should say goodbye to Franny. It wasn't so much for friendship's sake as for the pleasure of the boast, to be able to say, I'm going, just as I said I would. I'm going away forever. He stepped into the box, fumbled for some change, then fumbled again, his fingers chilled, even through his gloves, to find the Cunninghams' number in the out-of-date directory. It was there. He dialed and prepared to disguise his voice if Franny's father came on the line. Her mother answered, however, and with a hint of frostiness brought her daughter to the phone. Will got straight to the point. He swore Franny to secrecy, then told her he was leaving.
With them?
She said, her voice barely more than a whisper. He told her it was none of her business, he was simply going away.
Well, I've got something that belongs to Steep, she said.
What?
It's none of your business, she countered. All right, Will said. Yes, I'm going with them.
There was no doubt in his feverish head that this was so.
Now, what have you got?
You mustn't say anything. I don't want them to come looking.
They won't.
She paused a moment, then she said,
Sherwood found a book. I think it belongs to Steep.
Is that all? He said. A book? Who cared about a book? But he supposed she needed some memento of this adventure, however petty.
It's not just any book, she insisted. It's...
But Will was already done with the conversation.
I have to go, he said. Wait, Will.
I haven't got time. Bye, Franny. Say bye to Sherwood, will you? He put the receiver down, feeling thoroughly pleased with himself. Then he left the relative comfort of the telephone box and set out on the track to Bartholomeus's courthouse. The fallen snow had frozen and formed a glittering skin on the road ahead, upon which a new layer of snow was being deposited as the storm intensified. Its beauty was his to appreciate, and his alone. The people of Burnt Yarley were at home tonight, beside their fires, their cattle gathered into sheds and byres, their chickens fed and locked up in their coops for the night. The mounting blizzard soon turned the scene ahead of him into a white blur, but he had sufficient wits about him to watch for the place in the hedge where he'd previously gained access to the field, and, spotting it, dug his way through. The courthouse was not visible, of course, but he knew that if he trudged directly across the meadow, he'd reach its steps in due course. It was harder going than the road, and his body, for all its determination, was showing signs of surrender. His limbs felt jittery, and the urge to sink down in the snow for a while and rest grew stronger with every step. But he saw the courthouse now, coming out of the blizzard. Jubilant, he wiped the snow from his numbed face, so that the blaze in him, in his eyes, in his skin, would be readily seen. Then he started up the step. Only when he reached the top did he realize that Jacob was in the doorway, silhouetted against a fire burning in the vestibule. This was not a piffling blaze like the one Will had fed. It was a bonfire, and he didn't doubt for a moment it had living fuel. He couldn't see what exactly, nor did he much care. It was his idol he wanted to see, and be seen by. More than seen, embraced. But Jacob didn't move, and a terror came upon Will that he'd misunderstood everything, that he was no more wanted here than at the house he'd left. He stopped, one step shy of the top, and waited for judgment. It didn't come. He was not even certain Jacob had even seen him. And then, out of the shadowed face, a soft, raw voice. "I came out here without even knowing why. Now I see." Will dared a syllable.
"Me?"
Jacob nodded. "I was looking for you," he said. and opened his arms. Will would have gone into them happily, but his body was too weak to get him there. As he climbed the final step, he stumbled, his outstretched hands moving too slowly to protect his head from striking the cold stone. He heard Jacob let out a little shout as he fell, then the sound of the man's boots crunching on the frost as he came to help. "Are you all right?" he asked. Will thought he answered, but he wasn't certain. He felt Steep's arms beneath him, however, lifting him up, and the warmth of the man's breath on his frozen face. "I'm home," he thought, and passed out. Chapter 6. Thursday's evening meal in the Cunninghams' house was in winter a hearty lamb stew, mashed potatoes and buttered carrots, preceded always by the prayer that the family recited before every meal. "For what we are about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful." There was very little talk around the table tonight, but that was not unusual. George Cunningham was a great believer in things having their proper time and place. The dinner table was for dining, not for talking. There was only one exchange of any length, which took place when George, observing Franny toying with her food, told her sharply to eat up.
"I'm not really hungry," Franny replied.
"Are you sickening for something?" he said. "I wouldn't be surprised after yesterday."
"George," his wife said, casting a fretful glance at Sherwood, who was also not showing much of an appetite.
"Well, look at the pair of you," George said, his tone warming. "You look like a pair of drowned pups, you do."
He patted his daughter's hand. "A mistake's a mistake, and you made one. But that's the end of it as far as your mum and I are concerned. As long as you learned your lesson. Now eat up and give your dad a smile." Franny tried.
"Is that the best you can do?" her father chuckled. "Well, you'll brighten up after a good night's sleep. Have you got a lot of homework?"
"A bit."
"You go up and do it, then. Your mum and Sherwood'll take care of the dishes."
Grateful to be away from the table, Franny took herself upstairs, fully intending to prepare for the history test that was looming. But the book before her was as incomprehensible as Jacob's journal, and a good deal less intriguing. At last, she gave up on the life of Anne Boleyn, and guiltily pulled the journal out of its hiding place to puzzle over it afresh. She'd scarcely opened it, however, when she heard the telephone ring, and her mother, having talked a few moments, called her to the landing. She slid the journal out of sight beneath her study books, and went to the top of the stairs.
"It's Will's father on the phone," her mother said.
"What does he want?" Franny said, knowing full well.
"Will's disappeared," her mother said. "Do you know where he might have gone?"
Franny gave herself a few moments to think it over. While she did so, she heard the gale bringing snow against the landing window, and thought of Will out there somewhere in the freezing cold. She knew exactly where he'd gone, of course, but she'd made a promise to him, and she intended to keep it.
"I don't know," she said. "He didn't say where he was when he telephoned?" her mother asked.
"No," she said without hesitation. This news was duly communicated to Will's father, and Franny took herself back to her bedroom. But she could no longer concentrate on study, legitimate or no. Her thoughts returned over and over to Will, who had made her a co-conspirator in his escape plans. If any harm came to him, she would be in some measure responsible, or at least she'd feel that way, which would amount to the same thing. The temptation to confess what little she knew, and be relieved of its weight, was almost overwhelming. But a promise was a promise. Will had made his decision. He wanted to be out in the world somewhere, far from here, and wasn't there a part of her that envied him the ease of his going? She would never have that ease, she knew, as long as Sherwood was alive. When her parents were old or dead, he would need someone to watch over him, and, just as she had promised him,
that someone would have to be her. She went to the window and cleared a place in the fogged glass with the heel of her hand. Snow blazed through the glow from the street light, like flakes of white fire, driven by the wind that whined in the telephone wires and rattled around the eaves. She'd heard her father say, fully a month before, that the farmers of the plough were warning that the winter would be cruel. Tonight was the first proof of their prophecies. Not the cleverest time to run away, she thought. But the deed was done. Will was out there in the blizzard somewhere. He'd made his choice. She only hoped the consequences weren't fatal. In his narrow bed in the narrow room beside Franny's, Sherwood lay wide awake. It wasn't the storm that kept sleep from coming. It was pictures of Rosa McGee, bright, flickering pictures that made everything he'd ever seen in his head before look like black and white. Several times tonight, it felt as if she was right there in the room with him. The memory of her was so overpowering. He could see her clearly, her titties shiny wet with his spit. And though she scared him at the end, raising her skirts that way, it was that moment he replayed more often than any other, hoping each time to extend her motion by a few seconds, so that this time the dress would rise up to her belly button and he would get to see what she'd been wanting to show him. He had several impressions of what it was, a kind of lopsided mouth, a patch of hair, perhaps greenish like a little bush, a simple round hole. Whatever form it took, however, it was wet, of that he was certain, and sometimes he thought he saw drops of that wetness running down the insides of her thighs. He could never tell anybody about these memories, of course. He wouldn't be able to boast about what had happened with Rosa once he was back among his schoolmates, and he certainly wouldn't talk about it in adult company. People already treated him as strange. When he went out shopping with his mum, they'd peer at him, pretending they weren't, and talk about him in lowered voices. But he heard. They said he was odd. They said he was a little wrong in the head. They said he was a cross to bear, and it was good his mum was a Christian woman. He heard it all. So these rememberings had to stay hidden away, where people couldn't see them, or else there'd be more whispers, more shaken heads. He didn't mind. In fact, he liked the idea of keeping Rosa locked up in his brain, where only he could go and look at her. Perhaps he would find a way to talk to her as time went by, persuade her to lift her skirts a little higher, until he could see her secret place. In the meantime, he worked his belly and hips against the weight of the sheet and blankets, pressing his hand hard against his mouth, as though his palms were her breasts, and he was back licking them. And though he'd cried himself dry in the last little while, all his tears were forgotten in the thrill of the memory and the strange hotness in his groin.
"Rosa," he murmured against his hand, "Rosa, Rosa, Rosa."
Chapter 7. By the time Will opened his eyes, the fire, which had been in its heyday when he arrived, was now in its embry dotage. But Jacob had laid his guest close to it, and there was still sufficient heat in its dwindling flame to drive the last of the chill from Will's bones. He sat up and realized he was wrapped in Jacob's military coat and naked beneath.
"That was brave," somebody on the other side of the fire said.
Will squinted to see the speaker better. It was Jacob, of course. He was lounging against the wall, staring through the flames at Will. He looked a little sick himself, Will thought, as though in sympathy with his own condition. But whereas Will's illness had left him worn and weak, Steep glittered in his hurt. Pale, gleaming skin, shiny curls pasted to the thick muscle of his neck. His coarse grey shirt was unbuttoned to his navel, his chest arrayed with a fan of dark hair that ran over the ridges of his belly to his belt.
When he smiled, as he did now, his eyes and teeth glistened, as though made of the same implacable stuff. "You're sick, and yet you found your way through this blizzard. That shows courage."
"I'm not sick," Will insisted. "I mean, I was a little, but I feel fine now."
"You look fine."
"I am. I'm ready to go any time you want to."
"Go where?"
"Wherever you want," Will said. "I don't care. I'm not afraid of the cold."
"Oh, this isn't cold," Jacob said. "Not like some winters we've endured, the bitch and me."
He glanced back toward the courtroom, and through the smoke, Will thought he saw a contemptuous look cross Jacob's face. A heartbeat later, his gaze came Will's way once more, and there was a new intensity in it.
"I think maybe you were sent to me, Will, by some kind god or other, to be my companion. You see, I won't be travelling with Mrs. McGee after tonight. We've decided to part company."
"Have you travelled with her for long?"
Jacob leaned forward from his squatting position, and picking up a stick, poked at the fire. There was still fuel concealed in the embers, and it caught as he raked them over.
"More than I care to remember," he said.
"So why are you stopping now?"
By the light of the spluttering flames, whatever had been cremated there, it had been fatty, Will saw Jacob grimace.
"Because I hate her," he replied, "and she hates me. I would have killed her tonight if I'd been quicker, and then we'd have had us a fire, wouldn't we? We could have warmed half of Yorkshire."
"Would you really have killed her?"
Jacob raised his left hand into the light. It was gummy with something that looked like blood, but mixed with flakes of silvery paint.
"This is mine," he said, "shed because I failed to shed hers."
His voice dropped to a murmur.
"Yes, I would have killed her. But I would have regretted it, I think. She and I are intertwined in some fashion I've never understood. If I'd done harm to her..."
"You'd have hurt yourself," Will ventured.
"You understand this?" he said, almost puzzled. Then more quietly, "Lord, what have I found?"
"I had a brother," Will replied by way of explanation. "When he died, I was happy about it. Well, not happy. That sounds horrible."
"If you were happy, say so,"
Jacob replied.
"Well, I was," Will said. "I was glad he was dead. But since he died, I'm different. It's the same with you and Mrs. McGee in a way, isn't it? If she died, you'd be different, and maybe you wouldn't be the way you wanted to be."
"I don't know either," Jacob replied softly. "How old was your brother?"
15 and a half.
"And you didn't love him?"
Will shook his head.
"Well, that's plain enough," Jacob said.
"Do you have any brothers?"
Will asked him. Now it was Jacob who shook his head.
"What about sisters?"
"None," he said. "Or if I did, I don't remember them, which is possible."
"Having brothers and sisters and not remembering?"
"Having a childhood, having parents, being born."
"I don't remember being born," Will said.
"Oh, you do," Jacob said, "deep, deep inside."
He tapped his breastbone.
"There's memory in there somewhere, if you knew how to find it."
"Maybe it's in you too," Will said.
"I've looked," Jacob said. "Looked as deep as I dare. Sometimes I think I get a taste of it, a moment of epiphany, then it's gone."
"What's an epiphany?"
Will asked. Jacob smiled, happy to be a teacher.
"A little piece of bliss," he said. "A moment when, for no reason, you seem to understand everything, or know that it's there for the understanding."
"I don't think I've ever had one of those."
"You wouldn't necessarily remember if you had. They're hard to hold on to. When you do, it's sometimes worse than forgetting them completely."
"Why?"
"Because they taunt you. They remind you there's something worth listening for, watching for." So tell me one, Will said. Tell me an epiphany. Jacob grinned. There's an order. I didn't mean... Don't tell me you didn't mean it if you did, Jacob said. I did, Will said, beginning to see a pattern in what Jacob asked of him. I want you to tell me an epiphany. Jacob poked the fire one last time and then leaned back against the wall. Remember how I said I'd endured colder winters than this? Will nodded. There was one worse than any other. The winter of 1739. Mrs. McGee and I were in Russia.
1739?
No questions, Jacob said, or you'll have nothing more. It was the bitterest cold I've ever known. Birds froze in flight and fell out of the air like stones. People perished in their millions and lay in stacks, unburied, because the earth was too hard to be dug. You can't imagine... Well, perhaps you can. He gave Will a curious little smile. Can you see it in your mind's eye? Will nodded. So far, he said. Good. Well, now... I was in St. Petersburg with Mrs. McGee in tow. She hadn't wanted to come, as I recall, but there was a learned doctor there by the name of Kruslov who had theorized that this lethal cold was the beginning of an age of ice, that acre by acre, soul by soul, species by species, it would grasp the earth. Jacob closed his stained hand into a fist as he spoke, until the knuckles blazed white. Until there was nothing left alive. Now he opened his hand and lightly blew the silvery dust of dried blood off his palm into the dying fire. Plainly, I needed to hear what the man had to say. Unfortunately, by the time I arrived, he was dead.
Of the cold?
Of the cold, Jacob replied, indulging the question despite his edict. I would have left the city there and then, he went on. But Mrs. McGee wanted to stay. The Empress Anna, having recently executed a number of well-loved men, had commanded an ice palace to be built as a distraction for her disgruntled subjects. Now, if there's one thing Mrs. McGee loves, it's artifice. Silk flowers, wax fruit, china cats. And this palace was to be the greatest piece of fakery ice and man could create. The architect was a fellow called Iropkin. I got to know him briefly. The Empress had him executed as a traitor the following summer. It wasn't the last winter of the world, you see, except for him. But for the months his palace stood, there on the river bank between the Admiralty and the Winter Palace, he was the most admired, the most lionized, the most adored man in St. Petersburg.
Why? Will said.
Because he'd made a masterpiece, Will. I don't suppose you've ever seen an ice palace. No, but you understand the principle. Blocks of ice were cut from the river, which was solid enough to march an army over, then carved and assembled, just the way you'd build an ordinary palace. Except Iropkin had genius in him that winter. It was as though his whole career had been leading up to this triumph. He'd only let the masons use the finest, clearest ice, blue and white. He had ice trees carved for the gardens around the palaces, with ice birds in their branches and ice wolves lurking between. There were ice dolphins flanking the front door that seemed to be leaping from spumy waves, and dogs playing on the step. There was a bitch, I remember, lying casually at threshold, suckling her pups. And inside...
You could go inside, Will said, astonished.
Oh, certainly. There was a ballroom with chandeliers. There was a receiving room with a vast fireplace and an ice fire burning in the grate. There was a bedroom with a stupendous four-poster bed. And, of course, people came in their tens of thousands to see the place. It was better by night than by day, I think, because at night they lit thousands of lanterns and bonfires around it, and the walls were translucent, so it was possible to see layer upon layer of the place.
Like you had X-ray eyes.
Exactly so. Is that when you had your moment of epiphany? No, that comes later.
So what happened to the palace?
What do you think?
It just melted.
Jacob nodded. I went back to St. Petersburg in the late spring because I'd heard the papers of the learned Dr. Kruslov had been discovered. They had, but his wife had burned them, mistaking them for love letters to his mistress. Anyway, it was by then early May, and every trace of the palace had gone. And I went down to the Neva to smoke a cigarette or take a piss, something inconsequential. And while I was looking down into the river, something seized hold of my, I want to say my soul, if I have one, and I thought of all those wonders, the wolves and dolphins and spires and chandeliers and birds and trees, there, somehow waiting in the water, being in the water already, if I just knew how to see them. He wasn't looking at Will any longer, but staring into what remained of the fire, his eyes huge, ready to spring into life. And I thought, if I throw myself in and drown in the river and dissolve in the river, then next year, when the river freezes and the Empress Anna commands another palace to be built, I'll be in every part of it. Jacob in the bird, Jacob in the tree, Jacob in the wolf. But none of it would be alive. Jacob smiled. That was the glory of it, Will, not to be alive. That was the perfection. I stood there on the river bank, and the joy in me, oh, Will, the sheer, sheer, brimming bliss of it. I mean, God could not have been happier at that moment. And that, to answer your question, was my Russian epiphany. His voice trailed away in deference to the memory, leaving only the soft popping of the dying fire. Will was content with the hush. He needed time to mull over all he'd just been told. Jacob's story had put so many images into his head, of carved ice birds sitting on carved ice perches, more alive than the frozen flocks that had dropped out of the sky, of the people, Empress Anna's complaining subjects, so astonished by the spires and the lights that they forgot the deaths of great men, and of the river the following spring, with Jacob sitting on its banks, staring into the rushing waters and seeing bliss. If somebody had asked him what all this meant, he wouldn't have had any answers. But he would not have cared. Jacob had filled up some empty place in him with these pictures, and he was grateful for the gift. At last, Jacob roused himself from his reverie and, giving the fire one last desultory poke, said, "There's something I need you to do for me."
"Whatever you want."
"How strong are you feeling?"
"I'm fine."
"Can you stand?"
"Of course,"
Will proceeded to do so, lifting the coat up with him. It was heavier and more cumbersome than he'd imagined, however, and as he rose, it slipped off him. He didn't bother to pick it up. There was scarcely any light for Jacob to see him naked by. And even if he did, hadn't he taken Will's clothes off hours before and laid him down beside the fire? They had no secrets, he and Jacob.
"I feel fine,"
Will pronounced as he shook the numbness from his legs. "Here," Jacob said. He pointed to Will's clothes, which had been laid out to dry on the far side of the fire. "Get dressed. We have a hard climb ahead of us."
"What about Mrs. McGee?"
"She has no business with us tonight," Jacob replied. "Or, indeed, after our deeds on the hill, any night."
"Why not?"
said Will. "Because I won't need her for company, will I? I'll have you." Chapter 8. Burnt Yali was too small to merit a policeman of its own. On the few occasions police assistance was needed in the valley, a car was dispatched from Skipton. Tonight the call went out at a little before 8, a 13-year-old boy missing from his home, and the car, containing constables Maynard and Hemp,
was at the Rabjohn's residence by 1:30. There was very little by way of information. The lad had disappeared from his bedroom sometime between 6 and 7, approximately. Neither his temperature nor his medications were likely to have induced a delirium, and there was nothing to indicate an abduction, so it had to be assumed he'd left of his own volition, with his wits about him. As to his whereabouts, the parents had no clue. He had few friends, and those he had knew nothing. The father, whose condescending manner did nothing to endear him to the officers, was of the opinion that the boy had made for Manchester.
"Why the hell would he do that?"
Doug Maynard, who had taken an instant dislike to Rabjohn's, wanted to know.
"He hadn't been very happy recently," Hugo replied. "We'd had some hard words, he and I."
"How hard?"
"What are you implying?"
Hugo sniffed. "I'm not implying anything. I'm asking you a question. Let me put it more plainly. Did you give the lad a beating?"
"Good God, no. And may I say I resent—"
"Let's put your resentments over to one side for now, shall we?" Maynard said. "You can resent me all you like when we've found your kid. If he is wandering around out there, then we haven't got a lot of time. The temperature's still dropping."
"Would you kindly keep your voice down?"
Hugo hissed, glancing toward the open door.
"My wife's in a bad enough state as it is."
Maynard gave his partner a nod. "Have a word with her, will you, Phil?"
"There's nothing she knows that I don't," Hugo replied.
"Oh, you'd be surprised what a child will tell one parent and won't tell the other," Maynard replied.
"Phil'll be gentle, won't you, Phil?"
"Kid gloves?" He slipped away. "So, you didn't hit him," Maynard said to Hugo, "but you've had some words."
"He'd been behaving like a damn fool."
"Doing what?"
"Nothing of any significance," Hugo said, waving the question away. "He went off one afternoon."
"So he's run away before?"
"He was not running away."
"Maybe that's what he told you."
"He doesn't lie to me,"
Hugo snapped. "How would you know?"
"Because I can see right through the boy,"
Hugo replied, giving Maynard the weary gaze he usually reserved for particularly slow students. "So, when he went off for the afternoon, do you know where he went?" Hugo shrugged.
"Nowhere, as usual."
"If you were as communicative with your son as you've been with me, it's no wonder he's a runaway," Maynard said. "Where did he go?"
"I don't need a lecture on parenting from the likes of you," Hugo replied. "The boy's 13. If he wants to go traipsing the hills, that's up to him. I didn't ask for details. I was only angry because Eleanor was so upset."
"You think he went on to the Fells?"
"That was the impression I got."
"So tonight he could be doing the same thing?"
"Well, he'd have to be completely out of his mind to go up there on a night like this, wouldn't he?"
"It depends how desperate he is, doesn't it?" Maynard replied. "Frankly, if I had you for a father, I'd be suicidal." Hugo began an outraged retort, but Maynard was already on his way out of the room. He found Phil in the kitchen, pouring tea. "We've got a hill search on our hands, Phil. You'd better see what help we can get locally." He peered out of the window. "It's getting worse out there. What state's the mother in?" Phil made a face. "Out of it," he said. "She's got enough pills in there to sedate the whole bloody village. She must have been quite a looker, too." "So that's why you're making her tea," Doug replied, nudging him in the ribs. "You wait till I tell your Cathy." "Makes you wonder, eh?"
"What?"
"Rabjohn's and her and the kid." He stirred a spoonful of sugar into the tea. "Not a lot of happiness."
"What's your point?"
"Nothing," Phil said, tossing the spoon into the sink. "Just not a lot of happiness, that's all." It wasn't the first time a search party had been organised in the valley. At least once or twice a year, usually in the early spring or late autumn, a fell walker would be late returning to a rendezvous and, if the situation was deemed sufficiently serious, a team of volunteers would be drummed up to help with the search. The fells could be treacherous at such times, Sudden mists swept in to obscure the way. Scree and boulders could provide unreliable perches. Usually these incidents ended happily, but not always. Sometimes a body came down from the hills on a stretcher. Sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, no trace was ever found. The victim gone into a crevice or a pothole and never retrieved. At a little after 10, Franny heard cars in the street and got up out of bed to see what was going on. It wasn't hard to guess. There was a knot of perhaps 12 men, all bundled up against the blizzard, conferring in the middle of the street. Though they were some distance away and the snow was thick, she could name a few of them. Mr. Donnelly, who had the butcher's shop, was recognisable. There wasn't a bigger belly in the village. And his son Neville, with whom Franny went to school, was shaping up the same way. She also recognised Mr. Sutton, who ran the pub, his big red beard as distinct as Mr. Donnelly's stomach. She looked for her father, but she couldn't see him. He'd broken his ankle playing football the previous August, and it was still giving him trouble, so Franny assumed he decided, or been persuaded by her mum, not to join the search party. The men were dividing up now, four groups of three and one group of two. She watched while they all trudged back to their cars and, with much shouting back and forth, got in. There was a small traffic jam in the middle of the street while some of the vehicles turned around and others came alongside one another so that drivers could exchange last-minute instructions. But the street finally emptied. The sound of the car engines receded into silence as the searchers went their separate ways. Franny stood by the window watching the snow erase the criss-cross tyre marks in the street and felt faintly sick. Suppose something were to happen to one of the men. How would she feel then, when she'd watched them set off into the storm, all the time knowing where Will had gone? "You're a creep, Will Rabjohns," she said, her lips touching the icy glass. "If I ever see you again, you're going to be so sorry." It was an empty threat, of course, but it comforted her a little to rage against him for putting her in this impossible situation. And for leaving her, that was even worse in its way. She could bear the responsibility of silence, but the thought that he'd run off into the world and left her here, when she'd gone to all the trouble and the indignity of making friends with him, was unforgivable. As she got back into bed, she heard her father's voice downstairs. He hadn't gone. That at least was some comfort to her. She couldn't catch what he was saying, but she was reassured by the slow, familiar rhythms of his voice, and, soothed by them as surely as by a lullaby, she let her unhappiness go and fell asleep. Chapter 9. The climb was not arduous for Will, not with Jacob at his side. All the man had to do when the way became too steep or slippery was to lay his bare hand lightly on the back of Will's neck, and a portion of Jacob's strength would pass from fingers to nape, enabling Will to match him stride for stride. Sometimes, after a touch like this, it seemed to Will he was not climbing at all, but gliding over the snow and rock effortlessly. The wind was too strong for words to be exchanged, but more than once he felt Jacob's mind moving close to his. When it did, his thoughts went where they were directed, up the slope where their destination could be glimpsed on occasion, and down into the valley they'd escaped, its petty perfection visible when the gusts dropped. Will wasn't shocked by this intimacy, mind with mind. Steep was unlike other people. Will had realised that from the very beginning. "Living and dying, we feed the fire." That was not a lesson that just anybody could teach. He joined forces with a remarkable man, whose secrets would slowly be uncovered as they grew to know each other in the years to come. Nor would there be any limit to their knowing. That thought was clearer in his head than any other, and he was certain Steep had read it there. Whatever this man asked of him, he would supply. That was how it would be between them from now on. It was the least he could do for someone who had already given him more than any other living soul. Down in the courthouse, Rosa sat in the dark and listened. Her hearing had always been acute, sometimes distressingly so. There were times, days, weeks even, when she would deliberately drink herself into a mild state of befuddlement, usually on gin, but scotch would do, in order to muffle the sounds that came at her from every direction. It didn't always work. In fact, it had backfired on her several times, and instead of dimming the din of the world, it had simply stripped her of her power to control her own wits. Those were terrible times, sickening times. She would rage around, threatening to do herself harm, pricking out her ears or plucking out her eyes, and might have done it too, if Jacob hadn't been there to soothe her with a fuck. That usually did the trick. She'd have to be careful with the drinking in future, she mused, at least until she'd found someone to couple with her in Steep's place. It was a pity the boy was so young, otherwise she might have toyed with him for a while. She'd have worn him out, of course, all too quickly. When on occasion she'd taken any man besides Steep to her bed, she'd always been disappointed. However virile, however heated they appeared to be, none of them had ever shown a smidgen of Jacob's staying power. Damn it, but she would miss him. He'd been more than a husband to her, more than a lover. He'd been a goad to excess, calling forth all manner of behaviour she'd never have dared indulge, much less enjoy, in any other company, man or beast. Beast! Now there was a thought. Maybe she would be wiser looking for a fuckmate outside her own species. She'd dallied with this before. A stallion called Talis had been the lucky creature. But she hadn't given the affair full rein, so to speak. It had seemed at the time a cumbersome way to be serviced, not to say unsanitary. With Jacob gone, however, she would certainly need to broaden her palate. Maybe with a little patience she'd find a creature the equal of her ardour, out in the wild. Meanwhile, she listened, to the snow falling on the courthouse roof and on the step, on the grass, on the road, on the houses, on the hills, to a dog barking, to cattle lowing in a byre, to the babble of televisions and the bawling of children, and somebody old and phlegmatic. She couldn't tell whether it was a man or a woman. Age eroded the distinctions. Talking nonsense in his or her sleep. Then somebody closer. Footfalls on the icy road. A breath snatched from chapped lips. No, it wasn't one breath. It was two. Both male. After a moment, one spoke. "What about the courthouse?" It was a fat man's voice, she judged. "I suppose we could take a look," said the other without much enthusiasm. "If the kid had some sense, he'd get out of the cold." "If he had some sense, the little bugger wouldn't have run away in the first place." "They're coming in here," Mrs. McGee thought, rising from the judge's chair. "They're looking for the child. Compassionate men. How she loved compassionate men. And they think maybe they'll find him in here." She brushed the hair back from her brow and pinched some colour into her cheeks. It was the least she could do. Then she started to unbutton her dress, so as to hold their attention when they entered. Perhaps, after all, she wouldn't have to stoop to barnyard couplings. Perhaps two would replace the departed one, at least for tonight.